I'd like to read some background. In the Minneapolis Star of August 6, 1972, there was an article quoting from James Carberry in the Wall Street Journal. America has a rich pantheon of folk heroes built to giant size by tales spun in woods and workshop. There are those whoppers told around the campfire by muscle-bound lumberjacks of the Pacific Northwest that put life into Paul Bunyan and his blue ox Babe. Alas, we've all been gulled. The stories about these men are not true folklore, but fake lore. As Richard M. Dorson, professor of history and folklore at Indiana University, calls it. He and other debunkers had been tunneling under the origins of many folk myths and finding that they did not spring from the folk at all. According to Professor Dorson and other serious students, true folklore has two necessary ingredients: origin and widespread use among the people directly involved, and a strong oral tradition in which yarns are passed verbally from one person to another, getting embellished along the way. To qualify as true folklore, written versions of these stories should spring from the oral ones and follow them closely. Many tales originated not with the folk, but with PR men or public relations men or writers with nothing better to write about, and were spread by the mass media or by companies trying to squeeze a buck out of them. Well, the Westwood Lumber Company wanted to make a buck out of them. Paul Bunyan, for example, sprang from the fevered typewriter of the late W.B. Lawhead, an ad man for the now defunct Red River Lumber Company of Minneapolis in Westwood, California. He began writing promotional pamphlets featuring Bunyan in 1914. Now, Lawhead's name is spelled L-A-U-G-H-E-A-D, Laughhead, but is pronounced Lawhead, L-A-W-E-D. To his astonishment, they were an instant smash with the public, and the Bunyan legend was fed by a torrent of books, newspaper, and magazine articles, even inspiring operas, ballads, paintings, and sculptures. As late as 1958, Walt Disney Productions released a Bunyan film amid ballyhoo, claiming that hundreds of lumberjacks and sawmill hands have had a hand in fashioning this giant's repute in the past 100 years. Actually, the early lumberjacks had no idea who he was, said this professor of English at the University of Pennsylvania, and an investigator of the Bunyan legend. Well,
John, when did this guy write this stuff?
What?
What year? You know when he wrote it?
Yeah, I'll come to that. Now, on the date that I read this was in 1972. Let me see what I did with that. And on the 6th of September of August 1972, well, that's the one I read. That was the 6th, and on the 8th, 2 days later, the editor of the Minneapolis Star wrote this in the editorial page. We view with mixed emotions the debunking of the legend of Paul Bunyan, one of our favorite folk heroes. The legendary lumberjack, according to an Indiana University professor of history, was not created in the lumber camps of northern Minnesota, and so on. And he reiterated some of these things that the professor wrote. And he says the copywriter, according to the historian, was the late W.B. Lawhead, a mythical name, he says, who began writing pamphlets featuring Bunyan in 1914. We don't believe Bemidji and Brainerd are going to rush out and destroy their life-size statues of Paul Bunyan when they learn this debunking hit the news, They might, however, considering erecting alongside a small statue, even a tablet, commemorating Admin Lloyd, who probably never saw a lumber camp but still created a legend. Well, then I got into the action. And I wrote to the editor. I didn't know he was going to publish it. And I wrote him a letter, and he published the whole thing. And this is dated August 19th, 1972. And I wrote to him, to the editor, "Take heart. Paul Bunyan is not just a figment of the imagination of a Minneapolis copywriter of mythical names, as has been charged. W.B. Lloyd worked for the Red River Lumber Company under T.B. Walker, and he was the founder of the Walker Art Institute in Minneapolis. And from the time I knew him until he moved to Westwood, California, we worked in the drafting section of the engineering department of the then Northern Pacific Railway in St. Paul."
You knew this guy, Lloyd?
What?
You knew this guy, Lloyd?
Oh, yes. Worked with him. In the same... If, as suggested, he probably never saw a lumber camp, he knew the jargon: bushwhacker, PV, crosshauls, pike poles, river pigs, swamping, skidding, picaroons, and so forth. He gave me a copy of the 7th edition, 1935, of the booklet, Paul Bunyan and His Big Blue Ox, that's this, which contains 37 pages, including about 35 of his cartoons. He was an artist, this Lloyd, illustrations. The frontispiece states, in title format, "The marvelous exploits of Paul Bunyan is told in the camps of the White Pine lumbermen for generations, during which time the loggers have pioneered the way through the North Woods from Maine to California. Collected from various sources and embellished for publication, text and illustrations by W.B. Lloyd, published for the amusement of our friends by the Red River Lumber Company, Minneapolis, Westwood, California, Chicago, Los Angeles, San Francisco." And then it tells, I wrote that the Red River Lumber Company takes its names from the Red River of the North, and so forth. I won't read all of that. And there is the following editorial note. "The first edition of Paul Bunyan and His Big Blue Ox appeared in 1922 with 10,000 copies, followed in the same year with a printing of 5,000. Subsequent editions were printed in 1924, 27, and 31. Since the first editions, copies have been sent out only on request." And then they had revised the size of the book. "The students of folklore will easily distinguish," this is quoting from their book, "the student of folklore will easily distinguish the material derived from original sources from that written for the purposes of this book. It should be stated that the names of the supporting characters, including the animals, are inventions by the writer of this version, or Lloyd. The Oral Chronicle did not, in his hearing, which goes back to 1900, call any of the characters by name except Paul Bunyan himself. Investigators have failed to establish the source or age of the first Paul Bunyan stories. One of our correspondents, a man of advanced years, wrote us in 1922 that he had heard some of the stories when a boy in his grandfather's logging camp in New York, and that they were supposed to be old at that time. A distinct Paul Bunyan legend has grown up in the oil fields, evidently originating with lumberjacks from the northern and eastern white pine camps who came to work with the drillers." And in that same article, just below mine, Eva Dick Clemens writes, "Be it myth, folklore, or fakelore, or whether Brainerd, Bemidji, or even Maine wants to claim Paul Bunyan is irrelevant. This monstrous lumberjack began as a symbol used in advertising the bigness and sturdiness of the Red River Lumber Company. And the publicist of Paul Bunyan, William Barlow Lloyd, died around 1957 at the age of 74 in Lassen, California, and he was a cousin to Art Walker. Tribute should be given to the late Archie Walker, godfather of Paul Bunyan, who used the idea only for the purpose of selling lumber. However, the tales might be a tribute to the early lumberjacks who toiled in the North Woods. After several days, or maybe a week or so, after my letter was published, I got a letter from Jim Kearney, editor of Creative Communications, the Northliner magazine of the web publishing company. If you are the J.A. Nyquist whose letter to the editor appeared in the August 19th Minneapolis Star, here's a copy of our Northliner magazine that should interest you if you haven't already seen it. I refer you to page 12 and the real, unvarnished, unexpected, hitherto suppressed, almost never before revealed secret truth about Paul Bunyan. The headline may be a bit hyperbolic, but I think you'll enjoy the tale. Now, I need some collaboration for doing this. So, Paul, will you come in?
Come on, babe. Have a seat, babe.
There's a picture on the article. Can you see it? The magazine that, and I'll leave them so you can read it. But I knew Lloyd. We were draftsmen in the same office, and he was an artist, and later on he moved to Westwood, California. I don't think there's anything here that's additional that I should read. I will read some stories about Paul and his big blue ox. Babe, the big blue ox constituted Paul Bunyan's assets and liabilities. History disagrees as to when, where, and how Paul first acquired this bovine locomotive, but his subsequent record is reliably established. Babe could pull anything that had two ends to it. Babe was 7 axe handles wide between the eyes, according to some authorities. Others equally dependable say 42 axe handles and a plug of tobacco. Like other historical contradictions, this comes from using different standards. 7 of Paul's axe handles were equal to a little more than 42 of the ordinary kind. When cost sheets were figured on Babe, Johnny Inkslinger, that's the accountant, found that upkeep and overhead were expensive, but the charges for operation and depreciation were low, and the efficiency was very high. How else could Paul have hauled logs to the landing a whole section, 640 acres at a time? He also used Babe to pull the kinks out of crooked logging roads, and it was on a job of this kind that Babe pulled a chain of 3-inch links out into a straight bar. They could never keep Babe more than one night at a camp, for he would eat in one day all the feed one crew could tote to a camp in a year. For a snack between meals, he would eat 50 bales of hay, wire and all, and six men with picarooms were kept busy picking the wire out of his teeth. Babe was a great pet and very docile as a general thing, but he seemed to have a sense of humor and frequently got into mischief. He would sneak up behind a drive and drink all the water out of the river, leaving the logs high and dry. It was impossible to build an ox sling big enough to hoist Babe off the ground for shoeing, but after they logged off Dakota, there was room for Babe to lie down for this operation.
After they logged off Dakota.
Once in a while, Babe would run away and be gone all day, roaming all over the northwestern country. His tracks were so far apart that it was impossible to follow him, and so deep that a man falling into one could only be hauled out with difficulty and a long rope. One settler and his wife and baby fell into one of these tracks, and the son got out when he was 57 years old and reported the accident. These tracks today form the thousands of lakes in the land of the sky blue water of Minnesota. Because he was so much younger than Babe and was brought to camp when a small calf, Benny was always called the little blue ox, although he was quite a chunk of an animal. Benny could eat, could not, or rather would not haul as much as Babe, nor was he as tractable, but he could eat more. Paul got Benny for nothing from a farmer near Bangor, Maine. There was not enough milk for the little fellow, so he had to be weaned when he was 3 days old. The farmer only had 40 acres of hay, and by the time Benny was a week old, he had to dispose of him for lack of food. The calf was undernourished and only weighed 2 tons when Paul got him. Paul rode from Bangor out to his headquarters camp near Devil's Lake, North Dakota, that night and led Benny behind the sleigh. Western Air agreed with the little calf, and every time Paul looked back at him, he was 2 feet taller. When they arrived at camp, Benny was given a good feed of buffalo milk and flapjacks and put into a barn by himself. Next morning, the barn was gone. Later, it was discovered on Benny's back as he scampered over the clearings. He had outgrown the barn in one night. He was very notional and would never pull a load unless there was snow on the ground, so after the spring thaws, they had to whitewash the logging roads to fool him. Gluttony killed Benny. He had a mania for pancakes, and one cook crew of 200 men was kept busy making cakes for him. One night he pawed and bellowed and threshed his tail about till the wind of it blew down what pine Paul had left standing in Dakota. At breakfast time he broke loose, tore down the cook shanty, and began bolting pancakes. In his greed he swallowed the red-hot stove. Indigestion set in, nothing would save him. What disposition was made of his body is a matter of dispute. One old-timer claims that the outfit he works for bought a hind quarter of the carcass in 1857 and made corned beef of it. He thinks they have several carloads of it left. Another authority states that the body of Benny was dragged to a safe distance from North Dakota camp and buried. When the earth was shoveled back, it made a mound that formed the Black Hills in South Dakota. The custodian and chaperone of Babe, the big blue ox, was Brimstone Bill. He knew all the tricks of that frisky giant before they happened. "I know oxen," the old bullwhacker used to say. "I've worked them and fed them and doctored them ever since the ox was invented. And Babe, I know what pernicious old reptile, same as if I'd have been through him with a lantern." Bill compiled the Skinner's Dictionary, a handbook for teamsters, and most of the terms used in directing draft animals, except mules, originated with him. The buckskin harness used on Babe and Benny when the weather was rainy was made by Brimstone Bill. When this harness got wet, it would stretch so much that the oxen would travel clear to the landing and load, and the load would not move from the skidway in the woods. Brimstone would fasten the harness with an anchor Big Ole made for him, and when the sun came out and the harness shrunk, the load would be pulled to the landing while Bill and the oxen were busy at some other job. The winter of the blue snow, the Pacific Ocean froze over, and Bill kept the oxen busy hauling regular white snow over from China. M.H. Keenan, now I don't know, I suppose that was a friend of the author, can testify to the truth of this as he worked for Paul on the Big Onion that winter. It must have been about this time that Bill made the first ox yokes out of cranberry wood. Feeding Bill Paul Bunyan's crews was a complicated job. At no two camps were conditions the same. The winter he logged off North Dakota, he had 300 cooks making pancakes for the 7 axemen of the Little Charboy. At headquarters on the Big Onion, he had one cook and 462 cookies feeding a crew so big that Paul himself never knew within several hundred either way how many men he had. At Big Onion Camp, there was a lot of mechanical equipment, and the trouble was a man who could handle the machinery cooked just like a machinist, too. One cook got lost between the flour bin and the root cellar and nearly starved to death before he was found. Cooks came and went. Some were good and others just able to get by. Paul never kept a poor one very long. There was one jigger who seemed to have learned to do nothing but boil. He made soup out of everything and did most of his work with a dipper. When the big tote sled broke through the ice on Bullfrog Lake with a load of split peas, he served warmed up lake water till the crew struck. His idea of a lunchbox was a jug or a rope to freeze soup onto like a candle. Some cooks used too much grease. It was said of one of these that he had to wear caulk shoes to keep from sliding out of the cook shanty and rub sand on his hands when he picked something up. There are two kinds of camp cooks, the baking powder bums and the sourdough stiffs. Sourdough Sam belonged to the latter school. He made everything but coffee out of sourdough. He had only one arm and one leg, the other members having been lost when his sourdough barrel blew up. Sam officiated at Tadpole River headquarters the winter Shot Gunderson took charge. After all others had failed at Big Onion Camp, Paul hired his cousin Big Joe, who came from 3 weeks below Quebec. The boy sure put a mean scald on the chuck. He was the only man who could make pancakes fast enough to feed the crew. He had Big Ole the blacksmith make him a griddle that was so big you couldn't see across it when the steam was thick. The batter, stirred in drums like concrete mixers, was poured on with cranes and spouts. The griddle was greased by colored boys who skated over the surface with hams tied to their feet. At this camp, the flunkies wore roller skates, and an idea of the size of the tables is gained from the fact that they distributed the pepper with 4-horse teams. Sending out lunch and timing the meals was rendered difficult by the size of the works, which required 3 crews, one going to work, one on the job, and one coming back. Big Joe had to start the bull cook out with a lunch sled 2 weeks ahead of dinner time. To call men who came in at noon was another problem. Big Ole made a dinner horn so big that no one could blow it but Big Joe or Paul himself. The first time Joe blew it, he blew down 10 acres of pine. The Red River people wouldn't stand for that, so the next time he blew straight up. But this caused severe cyclones and storms at sea. So Paul had to junk the horn and ship it to the east, where later it was made into a tin roof for a big Union Depot. When Big Joe came to Westwood with Paul, he started something. About that time, you may have read in the papers about a volcanic eruption of Mount Lassen, heretofore extinct for many years. That was where Big Joe dug his bean hole, and when the stream worked out of the bean, and when the steam worked out of the bean kettle and up through the ground, everyone thought the old mill had turned a volcano. Every time Joe drops a biscuit, they talk of earthquakes. It was always thought that the quality of food at Paul's camps had a lot to do with the strength and endurance of the men. No doubt it did, but they were a husky lot to start with. As the fellow said about fish for a brain food, it won't do you no good unless there was a germ there to start with. There must have been something to the food theory, for the chipmunks that ate the prune pits got so big they killed all the wolves, and later, years later, the settlers shot them for tigers. A visitor at one of Paul's camps was astonished to see a crew of men unloading 4-horse logging sleds at the cook shanty. They appeared to be rolling logs into a trap door from which poured clouds of steam. "That's a heck of a place to land logs," he remarked. "Them ain't logs," grinned Bull Cook, "and sausages for the Teamster's breakfast." At Paul's camp, up where the little gimlet enters into the big auger, newcomers used to kick because they were never served beans. The bosses and the men could never be interested in beans. E.E. Terrell tells us the reason. Once when the cook quit, they had to detail a substitute to the job temporarily. There was one man who was no good anywhere. He had failed at every job. Chris Crosshall, the foreman, acting on the theory that every man is good somewhere, figured that this guy must be a cook, so it was the only job he had not tried. So he was put to work, and the first thing he tackled was beans. He filled up a big kettle with the beans and added some water. When the heat took hold, the beans swelled up till they lifted off the roof and bulged out the walls. There was no way to get into the place to cook anything else, so the whole crew turned in to eat the half-cooked beans. By keeping at it steady, they cleaned them up in a week, and they rescued the would-be cook. After that, no one seemed to care much for beans. It used to be a big job to haul prune pits and coffee grounds away from Paul's camps. It required a big crew of men and either Babe or Benny to do the hauling. Finally, Paul decided it was cheaper to build new camps and move every month. The winter, Paul logged off North Dakota with the 7 axemen, the little chore boy and the 300 cooks. He worked the cooks in 3 shifts, one for each meal. The 7 axemen were hearty eaters. A portion of bacon on one side of a 1,600-pound pig. Paul shipped a stern wheel steamboat up Red River, and they put it in the soup kettle to stir the soup. Like other artists, cooks are temperamental, and some of them are full of cussedness, but the only ones who could sass Paul Bunyan and get away with it were the stars like Big Joe and Sourdough Sam. The lunch sled, most popular institution in the lumber industry, its arrival at noon rendezvous has been hailed with joy by hungry men on every logging job since Paul invented it. What if the warm food freezes on your tin plate? The keel cold air has sharpened your appetite to enjoy it. The crew that toted lunch for Paul Bunyan had so far to travel and so many to feed, they hauled a complete kitchen on the lunch sled, cooks and all. When Paul invented logging, he had to invent all kinds of tools and figure out all his own methods. There were no precedents. At the start, his outfit consisted of Babe and his big axe. No two logging jobs can be handled exactly the same way, So Paul adapted his operations to local conditions. In the mountains, he used Babe to pull the kinks out of the crooked logging roads. On the Big Onion, he began the system of hauling a section of land at a time to the landings, and in North Dakota, he used the seven axemen. At that time, marking logs was not thought of. Paul had no need for identification when there were no logs but his own. About the time he started the Atlantic Ocean Drive, others had come into the industry, and although their combined cut was insignificant compared to Paul's, there was danger of confusion, and Paul had most to lose. At first, Paul marked his logs by pinching a piece out of each log. At first, Paul marked his logs by pinching a piece out of each log. When his cut grew so large that the marking had to be detailed to the crews, the scalp on each log was put on with an axe, for even in those days, not every man could nip out a chunk with his fingers. The grindstone was invented by Paul the winter he logged off to North Dakota. Before that, Paul's axemen had to sharpen their axes by rolling rocks down the hill and running alongside of them. When they got to Big Dick, as the lumberjacks called Dakota, hills and rocks were so hard to find that Paul rigged up the revolving rock. This was much appreciated by by the seven axemen, as it enabled them to grind an axe in a week. But the grindstone was not much of a hit with the little charboy whose job it was to turn it. The first stone was so big that working at a full speed, every time it turned around once, it was payday. The little charboy led a strenuous life. He was only a kid, and like all youngsters, like putting in their first winter in the woods, he was put over the jumps by the old timers. His regular work was heavy enough, splitting all the wood for the camp, carrying water, and packing lunch to the men. But his hazers sent him on all kinds of wild goose errands to do all parts of the works, looking for a left-handed peavey or a bundle of cross hauls. He had to take a lot of good-natured roughneck wit about his size, for he only weighed 800 pounds, and a couple of surcingles made a belt for him. What he lacked in size, he made up in grit, and the men secretly respect his gameness. They said he might make a pretty good man if he ever got any growth, and considered it necessary education to give him a lot of extra chores. Often in the evening, after his day's work and long hours put in turning the grindstone and keeping up fires in the camp stoves, that required four cords of wood apiece to kindle a fire, he could be found with one of Big Ole's small 600-pound anvils on his lap, pegging up shoes with the railroad spikes. It was a long time before they solved the problem of turning logging sleds around in the road. When the sled was turned from the landing and put on a heavy load, they had to wait till Paul came along to pick up the four horses and load and head them the other way. Judson M. Goss says he worked for Paul this winter. He invented the round turn, All of Paul's inventions were successful except when he decided to run 3 10-hour shifts a day installed in Aurora Borealis. After a number of trials, the plant was abandoned because the lights were not dependable. The Seven Axemen of the Red River, they were called because they had camp on Red River with 300 cooks and the little shore boy. The whole state was cut over from the one camp, and the Husky Seven chopped from dark to dark and rode to and from work. Their axes were so big it took a week to grind one of them. Each man had 3 axes and 2 helpers to carry the spare axes to the river where they got red hot from chopping. Even in those days, they had to watch out for forest fires. The axes were hung on long rope handles. Each axeman would march through the timber, whirling his axe around him till the hum of it sounded like one of Paul's fore and aft mosquitoes. And at every step, a quarter section of timber was cut. The height, weight, and chest measurement of the 7 axemen are not known. Authorities differ. History agrees that they kept a cord of 4-foot wood on the table for toothpicks. After supper, they would sit on the deacon seat in the bunk's shanty and sing "Shanty Boy" and "Bung Your Eye," till the folks in the settlements down on the Atlantic would think another Northwestern was blowing up. Have you had enough?
Keep going.
John, before you go on, were these stories that Law had put together, or did he make it all up?
Oh, he made these all the stories that you find in here.
But there are other tales. I mean, was Paul by Kinnett?
I don't know of any other tale. No, I don't think any tales ever were made about Paul Bunyan, except by Bill Law.
Okay, so he really was.
So,
had he done this before you knew him?
Well, some of it before I knew, yes. Mm-hmm.
Are you going to read us another one?
You want to hear another one?
Yeah.
One more.
Yeah. One more, okay.
That was great.
Well, maybe this might be a little appropriate for this time of the year. The winter of the deep snow, everything was buried. Sounds like Holden.
Yeah.
Paul had to dig down to find the tops of the tallest white pines. He had the snow dug away around them and lowered the sawyers down to the base of the trees. When the tree was cut off, he hauled it to the surface with a long parbuckle chain to which Babe, mounted on his snowshoes, was hitched. It was impossible to get enough stovepipe to reach to the top of the snow, so Paul had Big Ole make stovepipe by boring out logs with a long 6-inch auger. The year of the 2 winters, they had one winter, the year of the 2 winters, they had all winter, all summer. And then in the fall, it turned colder. One day, Big Joe set the boiling coffee pot on the stove, and it froze so quick that the ice was hot. That was right after Paul had built the Great Lakes. And that winter, they froze clear to the bottom. They never would have thawed out if Paul had not chopped out the ice and hauled it out on shore for the sun to melt. He finally got all the ice thawed, but he had to put in all new fish. The next spring was the year the rain came up from China. It rained so hard and so long that the grass was all washed out by the roots, and Paul had a great time feeding his cattle. Babe had to learn to eat pancakes like Benny. That was the time Paul used the straw hats for an emergency ration. When Paul's drive came down, Paul and the folks in the settlements were astonished to see all the river pigs wearing huge straw hats. The reason for this was soon apparent. When the fodder ran out, every man was politely requested to toss his hat into the ring. Hundreds of straw hats were used to make a lunch for Babe.